Whale, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, well, this evening we're going to have with us on the line Dr. Mark Geyer and his son David Geyer, and we're going to be talking about this terrible, terrible tragedy that is unfolding in our society. Some years ago, one or two, maybe three children per 10,000 was autistic. Today, well, it was 101 and 165. Within the last couple of weeks, the CDC has come out and said, well, it's really about 1 in 150 children are autistic in the United States. And in places like New Jersey, why, it's about 1 in 100. Other places, it may be 1 in 300. And then, of course, as you see, it's so much more common in boys than girls. Certainly, we would see a much higher incidence, of higher, much higher than 1 in 100 in boys in the state of New Jersey. And, of course, we know that, actually, according to the CDC's own figures, about 1 in every 6 children has some sort of neurodevelopmental abnormality. The government says, oh, shucks, we have no idea how this happened, but we can assure you it's not thimerosal. It has nothing to do with vaccinations. And they know it has. And they've had conferences, and they had one in Georgia where there was no question at all that in the process of the conference, they came to the conclusion, and the members of the CDC were there, and the World Health Organization, they all acknowledged that it was thimerosal, and then they lied about it. Well, Dr. Mark Geyer and his son are there on the front lines of this battle, trying to bring out the truth, and as far as I'm concerned, there is no question. The government knows they're poisoning our children. And not only did they take the thimerosal out of the childhood vaccines, but they left it in vaccines given to children knowing its toxic effect. And they're going to give those mercury-laden vaccines to poor children in third world countries because we love them so much. How could you justify giving mercury-laden vaccines to children in third world countries when we don't give them to children here? Although we do give our children mercury-laden vaccines, we just don't give them childhood vaccines, although we give vaccines to children. Well, that is the background. Dr. Mark Geyer, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having us.
And David, are you there?
Yes, hi, thanks for having us.
Well, it's good to have you both with us. Why don't you bring us up to date? I understand that you're involved with a lawsuit where the government, has you brought it, what is it, against the FDA, that they have to prove that thimerosal is safe before they put it in vaccines?
Yeah, let me bring you up to date. Actually, on what you said, I wish it were true that we don't give thimerosal-laden vaccines to young children in the United States. Unfortunately, it's not true.
Really? Have they deceived us again?
It turns out that if you listen to them carefully, they'll tell you that it's been removed or lowered in most of the childhood vaccines, except one, and that's the influenza vaccine. Unfortunately, in the last year or so, they've upped the amount of influenza. It used to be that young children were not even given influenza. Now they recommend two shots in the first 18 months of life and another shot each year following, each of which contains thimerosal. In addition, they're now recommending thimerosal-laden full dose to pregnant women.
We're going to do the most harm. We're going to be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, why don't you go ahead and pick up that thought that they're giving this to pregnant women during the first trimester of pregnancy. Isn't that going to do an awful lot of harm to the forming, to the brain that's forming in the womb?
We're very worried about that. And, you know, I'm an obstetrical geneticist, so that's really right up my alley. And I don't know the answer. I don't know whether it's worse to give it in the first trimester, the second trimester, the third trimester, but I know that it shouldn't be given to pregnant women. First of all, you shouldn't give any vaccine to pregnant women because, you know, you don't know what it does to the pregnancy. And secondly, you shouldn't give thimerosal full dose vaccine to pregnant women. That's terrible. It's awful that anybody would even think of doing that.
And, of course, giving it to children at 6 months of age and a couple of doses before they're 18 months. I mean, what they've done is they play word games. We've taken out of the childhood vaccines,
except
but we've
for the
left
ones
in vaccines we give to children.
Yeah, except the ones we didn't take it out.
Right.
And they keep increasing the number of those, and pretty soon it'll be back to where it was before.
Well, now, what is this lawsuit that you've been involved with?
We are part of a group that brought a lawsuit, what's called a citizen's petition, which is not a petition, it's an actual legal action, in which we demand that the FDA follow their own laws. And their law says that they cannot use thimerosal as a preservative unless they can prove it's safe and efficacious. And actually, they have to show it's safe at a much higher dose than what they use it. And, you know, they answered our petition by saying, well, they don't have any data, but they have administrative leave to do whatever they want, and it's fine, and the vaccines are good. And so we said that's not a lawful answer, and we're asking the judge to issue an injunction. And it's not an issue in the lawsuit of whether it causes autism. It's not our job to prove it causes autism. It's their job to prove that it's safe, not just for autism. It causes birth defects. It causes, there's evidence that it causes all sorts of things. And even if there's no evidence that it causes, they have to prove that it's safe with scientific tests. And their answer basically is, they have no proof, but they have administrative right to do it. And there's been a Supreme Court ruling that says they don't have administrative right. They have to follow the law. So we're asking the judge, make them follow their own law.
Of course, then, what is the response? My understanding that there was going to be some sort of a decision coming out this last week.
The last pleadings, I think, were in, and now we're waiting for the judge to see whether he wants to have a hearing or issue. We've asked for an injunction, an immediate injunction, and so far we don't have an answer.
Well, is this a jury trial, or is this just one man? Is this ruled by a judge?
This is this kind of thing. When you're suing the government, you can never have a jury trial. And there's no money, by the way, involved. All we're doing is asking them to order them to follow the law. So it's an individual judge in Washington, D.C., that by law, there's one court that's in charge of the citizens' petitions. And so it's a federal judge in Washington, D.C.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Mike Carr was saying that they have brought actually a legal action against the Federal Drug Administration, saying that they're required to follow the law. The law says that if the FDA is going to add something to a vaccine, they have to prove it's safe in a much higher dose than the dose which it's actually added to a drug, or in this case to the vaccine. The FDA has said, we don't have to follow the law. We have our administrative right to do that. We have no studies that this is safe. We have no studies that, that we could increase the dose and it would still be safe. But we don't have to abide by the law. How can government officials say that they're not held by the law if we are expected to abide by the law?
It's an amazing statement. I mean, they're saying they're the FDA and they can do whatever they want and the law doesn't matter. And hopefully the judge will... the federal judge will tell them they have to follow the law and they have to stop using it until they can prove it's safe and efficacious, incidentally. Turns out thimerosal, the sad joke of it is it's supposed to be a preservative, and it doesn't work. And they know it doesn't work, and in order to use it, they have to show it's both safe and efficacious. And they admit they have no studies that show that it's either safe or efficacious, but they're saying they're the FDA and they can do what they want, and there's not a thing anybody can do about it. And I think there is, and I'm hoping the judge will rule our way.
I also wanted to add that a really scary thing or very nasty thing in what their responses have been is that they tried to insinuate that we should be congratulating them, meaning the FDA, on the fact that they've helped to reduce the thimerosal in the vaccines. Their arguments go something like they recognized that there was too much mercury in vaccines, that children were in excess of the safety limits, and that they worked to try to reduce that limit, or try to limit that amount of exposure, and now what they're saying is, well, it's still in, for instance, the influenza vaccine, it's still in tetanus vaccines, and by the FDA's own estimate, it's in over 50 other over-the-counter products for the eyes, ears, nose, topical use, And those products, despite the fact FDA back previously said that the thimerosal was ineffective, we want to reduce it, all of those products are fine that are still on the market. So we congratulate them for recognizing it, for trying to eliminate it, but the ones that still remains in, it's still safe and it's still efficacious.
And we don't even know which ones, and they don't even know which ones.
And they don't know how much is present in the products either.
How much damage has been done to the minds of our people? And we hear this figure used over and over again. 1 in 6 American children has a neurodevelopmental problem, some sort of a learning or a physical disability. Are those figures accurate?
Well, you remember originally, if you remember, that we told you that in 2000, they said it was 1 in 166 and 1 in 6. 1 in 166 with autism spectrum disorder and 1 in 6 with ADHD. Now they've realized that the 1 in 166 is too low, and they've raised it to 1 in 150, and they're pointing out that in certain places it's higher than that. But even their own survey shows that they know that they're underestimating it. They're not even counting the kids that are, you know, in homeschooling or whatever. If you, nobody knows the exact number, but you want a guesstimate for me, and it's a pretty good one because, I mean, we work with this all the time. At the peak, when they were using the maximum dose, I believe the rate of autism in the United States was around 1 in 20, and the rate of attention deficit was about 1 in 3. And I'm conservative on that because Dr. Weldon, the congressman from Florida, thinks it's 1 in 1. He thinks even the ones that don't have ADD and ADHD have been damaged. They're just, you know, not bad enough to be diagnosed. I hope that isn't true, but the problem is just massive. The amount of damage to the United States is in excess of $20 trillion. And to put that in perspective, pretty soon the war in Iraq will reach $0.5 trillion. In fact, it's more money than we've spent on all the wars together, and that isn't even counting the 1 in 3. This is the worst catastrophe that ever happened in the United States, perhaps in the Western world. And they're having a lot of trouble, even though they control a lot of the press. They're having a lot of trouble keeping this elephant quiet. I mean, every time you look, people say, "Well, how come we have so many kids in school?" And I got news for you: pretty soon they're not going to be in school. And they're going to need to be put in institutions, and they're going to be aggressive. This is an aggressive form of autism, and they really can't keep it secret very much longer, and it's already starting to spill out. They can claim they don't know why, but boy, there's an awful lot of I don't know why.
But the thing is that, I mean, you're concerned, and you know, I'm concerned, and there are a handful of us who are concerned, but the average American isn't concerned because the government assures us that there is certainly no direct relationship to between the thimerosal and the skyrocketing incidence of autism.
Well,
and they say, just trust us, you know. You can trust us. Who would want to hurt a child? No one would want to hurt a child. Why, if there was any danger, why, we'd be sure this was taken out because we wouldn't want to hurt children.
Well, there's some new evidence now that makes it, there is no argument anymore, because what's been discovered is there's a laboratory test that anybody can do at LabCorp, which is the biggest lab in the country. We're not talking about some esoteric lab. And this is a porphyrin test. And the porphyrin test is a specific porphyrin found in the urine that's only found if you have mercury poisoning. And when I state that, that's based on 30 years of peer-reviewed publications. No one disputes it. Everybody agrees to this. They've measured it in dentists, and they have more of it. And when they looked at the autistics, they find that they have way more mercury than anybody else. But even in addition to that, if you look at a particular child, forget about the epidemic, forget about the epidemiology. You take a child and you draw his urine and it comes back mercury toxic. That kid is mercury toxic. You can't argue about that. And we've done that on our autistics, and the vast majority of them are mercury toxic. And we're not the only ones as a group in France that has published that. And it's really ridiculous to argue. At this point, it's like lead poisoning. You know, you can't argue about lead poisoning because you draw their blood and they have lead in their blood. Well, mercury poisoning, you take a urine sample, you show they have a particular form of porphyrin, and they have mercury toxicity. Now, you can argue where it came from, but, you know, most kids don't eat thermometers. They're only being injected with the mercury, so it's obvious that where it came from. And the dispute, the honest dispute, is long since over. Because in any individual child, I can tell you whether they are or aren't, and I can tell you with almost 100% certainty So this has become a ridiculous situation.
Well, why doesn't the American Dental American Medical Association or the American Associations of Pediatricians, I mean, come out and support your position? You know, why is it that you are sort of put into a fringe position? And I personally know that, in my estimation, you're absolutely right. But why isn't organized medicine backing you every step of the way?
You want to try that, Dave?
It has to do with the magnitude of the problem. What's happening in this country is really a seismic shift in disease patterns. Historically, if you go back 50 or 100 years ago, the great killers in the United States and in the Western world were infectious diseases. And thanks to good sanitation and part due to vaccination, we've vanquished or virtually vanquished most major infectious diseases. And what's come up in its stead is this horrific epidemic of chronic disability. And it's things like autism, it's things like diabetes, cancer, there's a huge list of them, asthma, allergies. And what we're seeing now is that by some estimates, half or more than half of the children have some kind of chronic disability. And what we're saying is that there's a cause for that, and that mercury is a big cause. And unfortunately for mainline medicine, it looks like their drugs, primarily vaccines, but also amalgams, which are mercury in the teeth fillings, mercury in topical ointments, eye ointments, ear ointments, these different exposure routes are contributing in a big way to chronic disabilities. And so this is a big problem. What you're saying is mainline medicine has helped to poison probably almost two generations of Americans. And even those of us who are not affected, we did get these toxins in our body. And unfortunately, mercury has this nasty propensity. Once it gets into a tissue like the brain, it doesn't leave. So we're walking around carrying mercury from medicinal sources in our body. And it accumulates over time as we eat fish, as we get new amalgams places, when we go and get our influenza vaccinations. And at some point, everybody reaches their toxic tipping point. It's just a question of how long and sort of how much mercury we can tolerate.
Well, I certainly think it's one of the great tragedies of our time. Now, my understanding is that you actually have come up with a treatment that's really offered some hope for these autistic children. If you read what the mainline media tells us, oh my goodness, isn't this a terrible thing? Well, you know, there's no treatment for it, so what we really want to do is get them into special schools and where they get special education. But certainly there are a lot of quacky ideas out there like detoxifying and certainly using some of these cleansing procedures, but none of these really work, and they're really potentially dangerous. And so we just want you to get used to it and put these children into special schools.
And that's what we sort of felt that way too, because remember, I'm not alternate medicine. I'm mainline Johns Hopkins NIH medicine. But it turns out that we've made what I think is a really major discovery. And it's a discovery that the world of kids who have autism and ADD can look at and see that we're right. If you look at these kids, even clinically, just look at them, you'll see that they have forms of precocious puberty. That is, they masturbate when they're very young, they have hair, they develop genitally. And we've been testing these kids, and they have high levels of testosterone. And we have, before we tested them, we predicted that the mercury will interfere in the pathway to make androgens in such a way that it will raise testosterone. And when you raise the testosterone, you'll make the mercury poisoning worse. And we found that we can treat the testosterone level and get amazing responses within a couple of months in most of the kids.
And, of course, then you go ahead and you detoxify them by one or another means. And when we get back, why, I really want you to tell us about some of the amazing results you've had. And I know you have well over 125 children you've treated this way. And ladies and gentlemen, there's a great deal that can be done. The tragedy is, everything is being done to tell physicians nothing can be done, or why we're just going to have to live with it. When there are treatments that are available, and we're going to tell you more about that in just a few minutes, and they're letting these children enter a life of hopelessness. Well, why don't you go ahead and tell us about these, what you really have done, how you're doing it, and what the results are of your treatment of suppressing the testosterone and then getting a lot of the mercury out of the brains of these tragic victims of a failed medical system.
Well, it turns out that the disorder called precocious puberty has been known for a long time. It's relatively rare, but about 1 in 5 to 1 in 10,000 children develop puberty much too early. And there's a wonderful drug that's been developed and used for over 20 years called Lupron, which stops the testosterone production and has been used safely in these children. And we've used the drug in children that have autism and precocious puberty. And we've not only stopped the precocious puberty, but we've stopped a good deal of the autism. We've made them improve tremendously. And we've had incredible success in over 120, as you said, over 120 children. We've even had some kids that were so bad they were institutionalized. And after our treatment, they've been able to come back home. One of the problems is that a lot of the current autistics, in addition to being autistic, that is, they don't socialize very well, are extremely aggressive. I mean, we're talking about they bat their heads against the wall. They put their mothers and fathers in the emergency room. They break holes in the wall. They break every pane of glass in the house. They attack people around them. And those kids, if you lower their testosterone, will do a lot better. And even the ones that aren't aggressive will do a lot better. Maybe David can have some thoughts on that.
What you really have to understand when you look at autism, and it's taken us a long time to really understand this, is that so many of the classic features of autism, whether it's social withdrawal, stereotypic behavior, the other elements in the criteria for autism, when you look at what testosterone does in its extreme manifestations, these are the exact things that you see in autism. And actually, research has been done to look at certain disorders, one called a congenital adrenal hyperplasia. This is where you naturally make very high levels of testosterone due to some abnormalities. And people have tested these children to look to see sort of how autistic they are. And what they've found is that these children with high testosterone tend to share more in common psychologically with autistic children than unaffected siblings. So that high testosterone, I wouldn't say that just because you have high testosterone, you're going to be autistic. I would say that it puts you at risk and it may make you have certain traits or behaviors that are associated with autism.
Now, do you think that this high testosterone level is primary or secondary? Do you think that it is the mercury attacking the endocrine system that leads to this high level of testosterone in boys of 4, 5, 6, or 7 years of age?
I think that there's a direct interaction. Mercury exposure will raise testosterone levels because of the way testosterone production is controlled. It's controlled by sulfation, and sulfation is inhibited by mercury, so that mercury exposure will drive the testosterone even higher, and once you drive testosterone higher, it's going to further impair sulfation. So you end up with sort of a cyclical interaction that's set in motion by mercury exposure.
All right, and I think that's really such an important fact. So it is the mercury exposure that is really creating this hypertestosterone response, and of course it is then the response to the high level of testosterone that allows or produces some of the erratic form of behavior, and we'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Dr. Mark Geyer, is a Johns Hopkins graduate, and he's mainline a physician. He's a geneticist. He works in obstetrical genetics, and his son is David. Are you still working on a PhD there?
I'm working with my dad mostly right now.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, they're their father-son team, and they're doing some of the really fundamental work. And what they've pointed out is that many of these autistic children are extremely violent. And much of this violence, and, the point of the fact that these children become totally uncontrollable, is related, of course, to the high testosterone levels. And, of course, this is a direct result of the mercury toxicity. So once you can begin to lower the testosterone level, how does that help you as far as getting the mercury out of the body, out of the system?
it turns out that we've actually, you know, we've brushed over by saying that mercury raises testosterone. We've actually worked out the exact biochemical pathway. We know exactly where the pathway is inhibited, and we know that high testosterone inhibits glutathione and sulfation, and the low glutathione sulfation raises testosterone, and you get a loop. Well, it turns out that glutathione, which is lowered by high testosterone, is your natural chelator. So because you have low glutathione, you can't get rid of your mercury. And many of our kids, we follow the mercury levels, and all we have to do is lower the testosterone, and they get rid of their own mercury. There are some that we go on to chelate, but we're not, as a mainline physician, I'm not a big fan of chelation, only do it when I really have to, but most of them will improve in their mercury toxicity by simply taking care of the testosterone problem.
And so how dramatic have those results been?
The stories are heartwarming, and we have a whole large group that talks about it and meets on it, and we've had a couple of kids that were in institutions. The parents didn't want them in institutions, but they were harming the parents and the people around them. We treated them with Lupron. They've been able to come home. We have other kids that, we have one child that was about 14 who was very smart. Not only, some of these kids are mentally retarded, but some of these kids are very smart. This one was very smart. You could talk to him about lunar landers. But in school, about once a week, he would either hit a teacher, hit a principal, break a hole in the wall, or threaten to rape a girl. They don't like that in school, so they suspended him, and eventually they expelled him. We found him to have the pattern of biochemistry that we told you, including high testosterone. We lowered his testosterone. We put him back in school. He hasn't had a problem since, and now he's getting ready to be in their advanced class. And in fact, he had a job offer from a zoo to work on snakes in the snakehouse because he's an expert on snakes. So he's become really a bright student who doesn't have a problem. Others we take that are extremely affected, have no language at all, and they don't improve to the level that he did, but virtually everybody, almost 100% of the kids that we have treated have improved markedly, and they continue to improve. We have one child that's on almost 3 years, and we thought, well, probably improve for the first year, but after that he won't get better. He's continuing to improve. He didn't have any words. He was functioning at about a one-year-old level. Now he's reading Harry Potter. He's learning to write.
I wish you had him reading something besides Harry Potter, but that's all right.
That's what the kids like, but I mean, that's age appropriate. We have this story after story like that where the kids are massively improved, and we haven't had any significant side effects since this is a drug that's safe for young children and has been used for a long time. And quite frankly, I never thought we'd have anywhere near the success that we're having now. We're actually treating people from all over the United States and even from Canada and even from England.
Well, of course, can you eventually get them off this anti-testosterone drug?
I think some of them can come off, and in fact, we have a couple that have come off and stayed much better. But I think some of them may need to be on for a long time. We also have an intermediate drug that you can take orally that might help them. And there may be some extreme ones that need to stay on indefinitely. But understand that if these kids are not on Lupron, they're going to be on SSRIs for the rest of their lives, Paxil, Abilify. And those things are terribly damaging, and they cost a tremendous amount of money, and they're going to end up in institutions where they can't even be taken care of there. These kids are even hard to handle in institutions, and if they're not in institutions, they're going to be very hard to handle in our society. In a few years, this will no longer be a deniable thing. I mean, these kids, the first wave of the epidemic will hit adulthood in about 4 years, and every year thereafter, there'll be more and more of them, and they're going to come out of school, and society is going to not be able to deny them. That's why they're slowly admitting, like the CDC did last week, that there are more of them than they thought, and they don't know what they're going to do with them.
Well, of course, they assure us that it's not related to thimerosal. We're going to be back here in just a moment or two with Dr. Mark Geyer and with David Geyer. This is one of the great human tragedies of today. And if you talk to the parents of autistic children, you know, they just, the families are destroyed, they end up with divorces, the total family is disrupted, and the lives of the other children in the family are disrupted. And what's so amazing is it's all unnecessary. And the people in the Centers for Disease Control have held their meetings. We know what they said. They had secret transcripts. Fortunately, Congressman Weldon got hold of the secret transcripts. And we know that they know, and yet they're lying and lying and lying. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening, Dr. Mark Geyer, David Geyer, and we're talking about this epidemic, this disastrous epidemic that is sweeping our country and destroying the minds of our young people. And of course, we're talking about a disease that's much more prevalent in boys than it is in girls, and destroying families, destroying really so much. And really, this will eventually bankrupt America, won't it?
I think it may bankrupt or significantly affect America and some of our close allies. I don't think the country will stop existing, but I think it will be a very different place when we have to spend a great deal of our gross national product taking care of these kids, and we have no replacements. We're killing some more of our wonderful young people in the wars, and also we're short of young people. As we all know, there's too many old people here, and we don't have enough workers. And now the people that are supposed to come up and work and support the rest of us, a good number of them are going to be autistic, and the ones that are autistic are going to have ADD and ADHD, and I think we're in for a world of hurt. I really do, and I think it's more than... And those people who don't have an autistic child or a child with ADD or ADHD might say, well, why do they care? I think they're going to find out why they care within the next few years, because all of us are going to care. It's going to affect everybody's life in this country.
Well, how old a child can you actually, how can they, old can they be when you start to treat them and still be able to get dramatic results? And I realize you're just in the very early stages of your treatment, but, I mean, is it 10 or 12 or 14? Can you still treat them at that age?
We have children that are teenagers into young adulthood. The oldest ones we've treated are around 20-ish in age. And I should note that we have seen significant improvement in those teenagers and young adults. I mean, let me just say from my own experience, my father sort of tried to capture what it's like being around these autistics, many of them. From my own experience, having now, you know, taken part and worked with my dad, when you start having autistics that are in their upper teens, early 20s, you reach a point where it can be very scary to sit in the same room with them when they're over 6 feet tall and they can, you know, knock a hole through the wall. It can be very physically challenging environment. And what we're seeing with Luperin is that those kind of behaviors, we can either completely eliminate them or certainly decrease the frequency, so that you have a child who, or a teenager that, basically, when they go into meltdown, they'll flail, they're out of control.
Hold that thought for us for just a moment here, please. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly David Geyer was talking about what it's like to be in a room with one of these children. Maybe they're 18, 20 years old. They will suddenly fly into these rages. They can simply just knock a hole in the wall, and they fly into rages. They're totally uncontrollable many times. And, of course, with their treatments, they can actually change the entire outlook for these children, and actually, hopefully, eventually down the line, they get off the medication. But right now, for the time being, they're keeping the children on the medication, and as they suppress the testosterone, then the child can begin to excrete the mercury on their own. Now, sometimes they actually do detoxify them. How often are you detoxifying the children?
Well, I think probably maybe one out of four.
One out of four,
that,
right?
That needs some additional help.
Now, how are you going about doing that? Are you doing with this material they put on the skin, or are you doing it by something given orally, or giving
all of our medicine is mainline medicine. So there is only one detoxifying agent really that's basically recommended for this. That's FDA approved, and that is called Chemet or DMSA, and we give it orally.
All right. DMSA, and that basically is the detoxifying agent as such?
It's called a chelating agent. It was actually developed originally by the U.S. Army because it gets rid of heavy metals, and I think the Army was more interested, rather than in mercury, in getting rid of uranium. They thought they were going to have a nuclear war and had to treat the troops for uranium, so they spent a lot of money developing this substance, and it removes lead, uranium, and mercury, and it's FDA approved, and, you know, insurance pays for it. It's the standard mainline medicine. And we only use it when we demonstrate mercury toxicity, which we can do with a urine porphyrin test.
Now, are almost all of these children you're treating positive for the urine porphyrin test?
Yes. We're finding, to give you an idea of how high the porphyrins are, if you look at where 95% of the children lie, we're finding that more than 50% of autistics are above that normal level. So in other words, there are more than 50% of the autistics are above the 95th percentile of normal children. So these children that have autism are extremely high. And we're seeing that with chelation therapy, we're able to lower that very high level back down to levels that are in the normal ranges.
As far as the porphyrin is concerned, so
yes.
You're really not actually measuring the mercury as such. You're measuring a marker for the mercury.
Yeah, porphyrin, we didn't explain what porphyrins are. Let me just quickly summarize. They're involved in the synthesis of heme for hemoglobin, and the porphyrins that we're measuring, since we're measuring it in the urine, are being made in the kidney. And it's been shown both in animals and humans that with mercury exposure, it causes an abnormal porphyrin to be produced, technically called precoproporphyrin. And absent mercury exposure, this particular atypical porphyrin is not found in the urine. And with mercury exposure, it's found to be present. And it's also been shown that the amount correlates with the degree of toxicity of the individual. So that we're seeing that our very severe full syndrome autistics have much more than, let's say, a very high-functioning Asperger's kid who can talk and at least limitedly interact with others. So that there's sort of a dose response. The more severely affected on the autism spectrum, the higher the levels of the porphyrins associated with mercury.
Well, now, how about the ADD and the ADHD? Have you looked into any of these? Do any of these children have an increase in the porphyrin, suggesting that there is mercury toxicity, or are you sticking primarily with the autistics?
We view something like ADD, ADHD as more on the autism spectrum, but they are a more mild part of the gradient, meaning that beyond Asperger's, it's sort of hard to define, but somewhere beyond Asperger's, you start moving more towards ADD and ADHD. So that they do indeed, some of them have high porphyrins as well. It's on average, though, their levels would be lower than somebody that has Asperger's, would be lower than somebody who has a PDD-NOS, would be lower than somebody who has autism. So it's a gradient there. It's a slope. More severe in the neurodevelopmental disability, the more of the precoporphyrin.
And we've been concentrating on treating the more severe ones in general. And there's another interesting thing going on in the country, which is there's a group called Neurodiversity who says that autism is a good thing and it's as natural as dreaming. And maybe they're seeing some very mild Asperger's that have some special skills. The kids we see wear helmets, bang their heads against the wall, don't say any words, and hurt people around them. These kids need to be treated. If they're very mild, maybe they don't need to be treated. So we're trying to take care of the ones that are absolutely intolerable in their home situations.
Well, have you published this? I mean, how have you disseminated information on your treatment? Because last time I talked to you, you had about 50 children. You're up to 120 now. And I'm sure that parents are just desperate to do something for their children. They want to do something. They go to the doctor, and the doctor says, trust me, I've read what the CDC says, and there's nothing that can be done, and certainly don't go to these quacks who want to take a lot of your money. And instead, you send your child, you know, to all these special schools that cost $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 a year. But don't go to those quacks who want to take all your money from you.
Well, let me just say something about education. You know, we're not anti-education. Clearly, if we could wave a magic wand and make all the autistic children perfect medically, these children would need a lot of intervention with education, because we sort of view it, they're sort of like in a coma or in a slumber,
right.
So that they've missed a lot of development. Education can be very useful for them. What we're trying to work on is to look at the biomedical things that are wrong with them. And really what we've done is sort of charted a whole new area of research. We initially published a medical hypothesis before we saw any children at all clinically, where we outlined some of these effects in autism about mercury, about glutathione, and testosterone and how they would interact. And then we've published a series of clinical papers documenting high testosterone, low glutathione, elevated porphyrin markers of mercury toxicity, and now just came out in the last couple of weeks is our first study on our initial series of children using our treatment protocol of Luprin and chelation in some of the kids, showing that after several months of therapy, overall we saw the severity of autism approximately fall in half in the children that we treated.
Well, I think it's really a miraculous thing. Of course, you know, there's always going to be the naysayers who say, well, but did you do a double-blind study? Oh, if you just did a double-blind study, then it would be significant. And they're always trying to find some reason to play this down. How do you respond to somebody who says, well, but do you have a double-blind study?
I think a double-blind study is a very nice thing to do. We're not in a position to do that because we're doing clinical work.
Right, I know you're
right. Comes to us, they want to be treated, they don't want to be double. We would very much support a double-blind study, but I must admit, and certainly I've been trained that that's the best form, but the response is so remarkable here that, you know, the double-blind study is so obviously that it would work. I mean, we don't tell the teachers that we're treating them, we don't tell their special ed people, and we get back within a few weeks to a few months, what did you do to the child? I mean, it's not the same child. They're so different that it's eminently obvious how much better they are. And, you know, if some university wants to do a double-blind study, we would help do it. But at this point, it's not, we're not talking about they're a little bit better. Well, we looked at them kind of funny. Maybe they're not a little bit better. The parents that we're taking care of, and the parents are not getting in this placebo effect. Many of these parents have tried many other things, and they said they didn't work. This one has worked so well that the parents, we've had parents cry, you know, to thank us that we saved their lives. It's so different. You see the kids, and it's not the same kid. And it doesn't take years and years. It takes, you know, weeks to months to see.
And we even see on individual children what's called the effect of positive rechallenge, meaning that we have some kids who are on our protocol with Luprin therapy and our other drugs. We saw significant improvements for a couple of weeks or a couple of months, and the drugs, for whatever reason, they were unable to get them in time, so the kids were untreated for a couple weeks, and then they went back on the drugs, and what they observed is that they were very good on the drugs. When the drugs weren't present, the bad behaviors that were there before came back. So it's a kind of, when the drugs were given, good things happened. Absent the drugs, it got worse, and then it got better again.
And, you know, I've heard this story from the parents, you know, when children have been treated, not necessarily with your treatment, but with other treatments that, you know, did decrease the mercury load, it was almost as if sort of a veil had been lifted. And, you know, the child could then begin to respond normally.
Yeah, it's very heartwarming, yeah.
I'm sure it is. Well, of course, have you had any, you know, are other physicians beginning to adopt this form of treatment? Where do you stand? And what is the people in the CDC and elsewhere say about this sort of thing?
Mostly they don't react to it because the CDC people really are epidemiological people. They don't understand the biochemistry. They don't even understand what the porphyrins do. We've had quite a number of mainline physicians that are impressed with this and some that are actually doing it. The usual story is we get a physician's child who we treat, and then he or she gets so much better. And we do females, by the way, and the females are rarer, but the ones that we do also have high testosterone and also respond very nicely to the therapy. But when a doctor child is treated, they then start treating other children around themselves.
Well, now are we beginning to see this disease of autism and these behavioral disorders in the third world countries where we are generously giving them the thimerosal laden vaccines? Are other countries having similar problems what we're having here?
They're even worse. We have one couple that they're both nurses, and they went back to Africa, to their country, because they're, you know, involved in the government there, and they were shown a tour of the country, and they came back and told us, you think you have a problem here. There, the problem is infinitely worse because all their vaccines have thimerosal, And they give them multiple times. They don't track like we do, you know, to give them so many times. They just go through the villages, and if you had them, they don't ask. They just give them again. And they said that it's amazing how much damage has been done to various parts of the third world beyond belief.
Well, do you think that the average American realizes the harm we're doing to Africa? I mean, most people think, oh, we're going over there because we want to help the children. How could the people who are funding this be so blind to the terrible tragedy they're creating?
It's hard to see to picture that they could be so blind. But, you know, if you look around at the history, I'm not a political scientist, but Americans have a lot of trouble understanding why a lot of places hate us. After all, we do try to help. I mean, we go in and we give them aid. But unfortunately, we also give them damage. And that's a good reason why they may not like us so much. Robert Kennedy Jr. wrote a big article about that. As I said, I'm not an international politician, so I don't know as much about that. But he says that a lot of them hate us because our aid actually causes them more difficulty than no aid.
Well, of course, of the Africans given the option of taking the vaccine or not, and they simply just round it up and give it to them automatically.
It's given to them at automatic weapon point, and they've admitted that.
In other words, they line them up and they point guns at them, and you're going to take this or else?
That's exactly right. And they don't ask if they've had it. This is vaccine day. They go through the village and they give it to everybody.
No, but they
might have come through last month and come through, but, you know, they don't have a good record system. And they actually admit that they use automatic weapons, and that the people, you know, try to hide in the bushes, and it's just a horrendous thing that goes on there. There's no informed consent there. And as a matter of fact, there's very little informed consent here. I don't know if you just heard recently, yesterday there was a big to-do. The CDC and the FDA made an emergency announcement that the new rotavirus vaccine was again causing intrusception. And so they put it on their website. This is the second time, you know, they withdrew one and they tried the second. We said if they did the second, it would do the same thing. It's doing the same thing. So get this. What they're going to do is they're going to put a warning on the vaccine that it may cause intrusception. So that sounds like not a bad idea. After all, it's informed consent. But wait a minute. What informed consent? They're going to force you to take the vaccine with or without the warning. You know, at least they pretend that you have to take it or you can't go to school. And if you don't take it, they're going to come with the health department and take your child away. But it's informed consent. That's not informed consent. Informed consent means you have a choice. And although people in this country do have a choice, they're being told that they don't. That is, most states, almost every state, if you have a religious objection, many states, if you have a philosophical objection, you don't have to take it, but they don't tell you that. They tell you you can't go to school. Well, actually, the law says you can't go to school unless you either give the vaccine or you sign the waiver. But they don't give you the waiver. So basically, we don't have informed consent on vaccines in this country either. And the public health people think that's the way it should be because it doesn't work very well with informed consent.
And because what we really need is if parents want their children vaccinated, that's fine. I think they're wrong, but that should be an opt out, not an opt in. I should be where they can opt in that we want to get them vaccinated. But here you it's very, very difficult to opt out and say I want to protect my child. I don't want them to have that vaccine.
And
of course, I remember when they withdrew the rota vaccine before because they had the intussusception. For our listeners out there in the audience, intussusception is where the bowel telescopes upon itself and produces an obstruction, and sometimes the children die. So, I mean, here we have a vaccine that's to save children's lives, and sometimes it kills them.
And actually, it turns out rotavirus is not much of a problem in the United States. But by the way, I'm pro-vaccine. David and I are both pro-vaccine, but we're pro-intelligent use of a vaccine with informed consent. And hopefully the vaccines would be so transparent and so honest that most people would voluntarily take them. We're certainly not in favor of any kind of medicine that's forced down people's throats, and that the public health people have actually admitted that they are willing to lie about what it is in order to get you to take the vaccine because they say the ends justify the means. The ends never justify the means.
And if people will lie about one thing, what else will they lie about? How many of our vaccines now still have thimerosal in them? We know it's still in the influenza vaccine, but what other vaccines? What about the pneumococcus vaccine or some of these other vaccines that they're giving so freely?
It's primarily in influenza. It's also in certain formulations of tetanus, certain formulations of meningitis vaccines. It's in a couple of esoteric vaccines that aren't usually routinely given. And then it's present at what they're calling trace levels. And let me just quickly differentiate. When we talk about something like influenza, what I'm talking about there is full dose, meaning 25 micrograms of mercury per shot or 12.5 micrograms of mercury per shot. There are a series of vaccines that have quote-unquote trace, meaning less than 1 microgram. And there's quite a list of those vaccines.
Are you recommending that the autistic children you're treating get the mercury fillings out?
Well, hopefully no children have mercury fillings. I don't think anybody should be given mercury fillings. But yeah, if you're an autistic, you must have your mercury fillings out, because otherwise you can't be chelated and you can't be treated, basically.
All right, fine. And if you're a parent out there, understand this, and yet there's still dentists that are putting their mercury fillings in, and of course there's no justification for it. You know, probably the group that has the highest suicide level in the entire country are dentists. And of course some people, because so many of them are mercury toxic because of what they do. We'll be right back to wrap up this evening's program. Mark or David, do you have a website that you'd like to put out? Mark or David? Do you have a website there?
We don't have a website.
But people can email us if they want.
All right, well, how can they get in touch with you?
Mgeier, M-G-E-I-E-R, at Comcast.net.
Mgeier at Comcast.net. Okay, fine. And we do hope that maybe there will be some people out there. What part of the country do you live in, so that people would know where you are, you know, if they wanted to come and get in touch with you? Incidentally, if you're out there listening audience and you didn't get the address or how to reach David or Mark Geier, why, you give us a call at Radio Liberty and we'll tell you how to get in touch with them. But certainly you are living on the East Coast, aren't you, practicing back there?
Yes, I practice in Maryland. We have offices in the Washington area and Baltimore area, but we are actually treating and working up patients from all over the country, and not all of them have to come here. We do a telephone consult, and we're able to do laboratory analysis through LabCorp, which is in virtually every state in the country, and we get the result here. And then very often we can get a local doctor to help give the actual treatment. So we can actually we're treating people all the way from Hawaii to Canada to, they don't actually physically always have to be there, although we like to see the patients at some point.
Is that included in your 120 patients, or is that are those separate from your 120?
No, that's in the 120. We have, I'd say, about a quarter of them are in the Maryland area, and the rest of them are scattered around the whole country, and some even international.
Well, I'm just hoping, of course, as time goes by, that you'll be treating thousands of these children, because there are really, literally, hundreds of thousands of children with autism throughout the world today. And they need to be treated. Do you think that you do a lot better when you get to them early?
Yeah, I think the prognosis, when we get to them really late, the main thing we can do is cut down the aggression. I think they get somewhat better, but the ones we get relatively early, we take them as early as 3, and I think it's optimal around 4, 5, 6 to maybe up to 9 or 10. Those children have the best chance of getting as close back to neurotypical as possible.
Do you think that their intelligence improves as well as their actions?
Yes. Well, I think their intelligence is hard to measure. So I don't know that it improves, but the way they function intelligently improves. That is, they may have, you know, a high IQ under there, but they're functioning 5 years behind their age level. And when we give our treatment, it's not just about aggression. They hear better, they think better, their receptive language becomes better, their spoken language becomes better. In fact, all the items of autism seem to improve.
Well, we're out of time. God bless. Thank you both for being with us this evening.
Thank you for having us.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and we have Mike on the line. They wanted to make an announcement about something happening locally. Mike, do you want to go ahead and announce that movie that's going to be shown here? What is the movie, and when is it going to be shown?
Yeah, thanks, Stan. The movie is 911, Dust and Deceit. It'll be shown. It's a presentation of the Santa Cruz 911 Truth Network. It'll be shown at the Veterans Memorial Building on February 22nd at 7 p.m. And the building is at 846 Front Street, right in downtown Santa Cruz.
Oh.
And the movie is about, like the title says, Dust and Deceit. It's the dust at the World Trade Center immediately after the collapses and following, and then the deceit that was perpetrated upon the citizens of New York and really the population of the, of our country at large, that led to, well, they lied and said that the air was safe to breathe and the water was safe to drink, and now we have many thousands of people coming down sick.
Okay, thank you very much, Mike. Okay. And certainly it's an excellent, excellent movie. I've seen it and actually interviewed the woman who, I think it's Penny Little who actually put that out. So let me recommend that. I think it's well worthwhile going to see. And if you didn't get the announcement, give us a call. But this is the Veterans Hall there. I think it's on the 22nd. Under any circumstances, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and quite frankly, we need your help to so we can maintain the network we have of almost 60 outlets every single week, but it's an expensive proposition, and we don't have any major sponsors. We just have people who are concerned about what's happening to America and agree with us that you can't understand anything going on today unless you understand there is organized evil in the world. Who would want to hurt children? And the answer is, there are people who really want to hurt them, and that's why they push abortion and partial birth abortion, and they've killed between 45 and 50,000, 50 million people, 45 and 50 million people here in the United States, and used American money to kill hundreds of millions through abortion throughout the world. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, there really are people who hate children, and they know exactly what they're doing. And if you wanted to do the maximum harm, where would you go to work? Would you go to work, you know, as a physician in a small community? Or would you get into a key position in government where your policies could lead to disasters? And remember, it is our public health service that monitored and blocked efforts to treat the AIDS epidemic as a communicable disease, and as a result, over 570,000 Americans are dead, and another, of course, 500 to a million people are infected and going to die. A totally unnecessary epidemic. If you have not read my book, AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic, let me suggest you get it. Let me suggest you get my DVD and or video, Planned Population Reduction, our four-tape set on population reduction, our population control, our video on population control, or what we refer to as the Population Control Agenda Monograph. There really is a genocidal agenda out there. You need to get, of course, the four-tape set, which it was based upon the talk given back in 1969 by the director of Planned Parenthood, one of the most amazing tape sets we have. It's called The New Order of the Barbarians, describing exactly what's going on today. But, of course, the talk was given in 69. You'll hear the Dr. Denninger, who attended the talk, telling you what happened and how they talked about how the Japanese had been making better cars, how the athletes had been making countless millions of dollars. This was 69. Everything is planned ahead of time. And if you think that the Japanese are taking over the car market by accident, you just don't understand. The four-tape set, The New Order of the Barbarians, so much information available from Radio Liberty. So give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please go to our website and of course, pray for America, pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, because we're on the front lines of this battle for the souls of men and the survival of civilization. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Christian civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They are my views and the views of our guest. And our next guest is Mr. Michael Payne, who comes from the TakeEastStandMinistry.org. That's TakeEastStandMinistry.org. And he is an advocate of course, increasing the number of troops in Iraq and just staying there. Because, of course, if we leave, why, of course, the terrorists are going to take over the country and the threat to the United States. So, without further ado, let's introduce Mr. Payne. Let him tell you a little bit about himself and why he has gone on a number of trips to Iraq. And perhaps he'll tell us who is funding this effort to he's going around the country advocating increasing the number of troops over there. Mr. Payne, thank you so very much for being with us. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and why you've made repeated visits to Iraq?
Well, I'm a veteran, United States Air Force, 1970 to 1975. Did not serve in Vietnam. Went through many years self-employed, but in 1999-2000, I became involved in Christian radio, and from that point forward, took a closer look at what our times, that the present times, have to do with the times in the Bible, etc. And then as the war broke out in Iraq, a year later, I started to see that the liberal media of this nation was twisting what was going on there and not bringing back the truth to the public here about the accomplishments of our troops in Iraq. So in the year 2004, the station that I was managing, small station outside of Washington, D.C., was sold, and that released me from that job. And at that point, I was moved to go to Iraq to embed with the 1st Cavalry. I went for a month in May of 2004, month of September 2004, and then from Thanksgiving Day 2004 until January 5th, 2005.
Well, can it just anybody go over there and embed with one of the military units?
Well, I was embedded as a journalist, freelance, and I believe I've been on your program before, but I come back, and special guest is the promoter that promotes me or gives me visibility across the country for programs like yourself and others who are interested to hear how our troops are faring in Iraq.
Well, it must be fairly expensive to go over to Iraq. Who actually funds your activities?
Well, various people who... I have a nonprofit called Take A Stand,
Take A Stand, okay.
TakeAStandMinistries.org, and there are various people who believe in what I'm doing, such, you know, private individuals. I believe in the Bible, and I believe the Bible is what it says fundamentally. I guess some would call me a fundamentalist, I guess, but I just believe what the Bible says, and I believe we're in those times. And as I came from problems of over the course of my life of depression and thoughts of suicide, etc., Jesus came into my life and delivered me from these things, and this is what I...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, I guess it's Mr. Michael Payne, and he's talking about his trips to Iraq. So he's been there on two occasions, and certainly I'm sure our troops are fighting bravely and doing the best that they can. But how can it be that we've been there longer fighting in Iraq than we fought during the Second World War? And things certainly don't seem to be getting any better. From what we hear, we're losing more people and more helicopters. And so we've been there all this period of time. Why haven't we won the war yet?
So you're asking me that question?
Yeah, right.
Well, I guess we haven't gone in and, number one, and fought it like we would fight in World War II. The enemy is not quite as visible. But we have also, from what I have seen there and the programs I've been told about by military personnel on the ground, and I don't mean generals and so forth, I'm talking about boots on the ground level. We're there to train an Iraqi army, help them get back on their feet with a new Iraqi army and Iraqi police force to bring security back to the people of Iraq. And I was just there, I omitted that I just got back from a 40-day trip, November 13th until the end of December this past year. And from what I saw on that trip back, the Iraqi army is becoming more proficient, and they are stepping up and now taking the lead. And from what I'm seeing in the news in the last month, with the crackdown in Baghdad and so forth, it seems that our troops are starting to make some headway there. And I believe that if we stand behind this plan without Congress doing all this bickering in the background and saying they're going to pull the troops out, which is an encouragement to these radical terrorists that are bent on destroying Iraq, taking that down, and Iran is intent upon destabilizing the Middle East and taking control, being the dominant power in the Middle East, and destroying Israel.
Well, then do you think we should go ahead and take down Iran as well?
Well, I don't believe it behooves anybody that Iran develop nuclear missiles and be allowed to strengthen themselves in that manner.
But certainly Pakistan has nuclear missiles, and they're backing the terrorists, so should we perhaps go to war with Pakistan? We'll be right back with Mr. Payne. Where does it end? Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Mr. Michael Payne, and Mr. Payne is just saying that he thinks we should stay in Iraq and continue doing what we're doing, and we can't let Iran get nuclear weapons. But I was just pointing out that Pakistan has nuclear weapons, and Pakistan is funding and backing the Taliban. Certainly seems to me maybe we ought to go after the Pakistanis, because they started out funding the Taliban. There wouldn't have been a Taliban if the Pakistanis hadn't funded it. So should we go after every Muslim nation, especially one that really is a threat because they do have nuclear weapons?
Well, I believe that some of them, and Iran is certainly a major player in turmoil and funding terrorists that are not only in Iraq, but are being sent into other places around the world. And so where do you allow that to continue?
Well, of course, who brought the mullahs to power? Do you remember back in 1979 when the CIA actually toppled the Shah, and then we ordered the Shah to leave the country and brought the mullahs to power? I never understood why we'd done that in 79, and unless maybe there was some sort of a long-range plan. But, I mean, where do we stop being the policemen of the world? Do you think that the average American really wants the Americans to run the world? I mean, after all, we've set up a command for Africa, and the Russians are saying the Americans want to run the world. Do you think that's the function of America? Do you think that's what the American people want?
Well, I don't think America wants to run the world. Obviously there are people in power in places who are trying to elevate themselves into a higher place of power, and greed and money, but that's not, I don't believe that is the total focus of America.
Have you read the report of rebuilding America's defenses put out by the Project for the New American Century? It's up on the Internet at www.newamericancentury.org. It's the website of the neocons who, back in 1968, were advocating going to war with Iraq, and in the year 2000 were advocating going to war with Iraq, and it's people like Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Jeb Bush, Paul Wolfowitz, John Bolton, there were only 27 of them originally, but they talk about how we've got to keep our troops in Iraq indefinitely. It's their report, not mine. Any of our listeners can check it out. Rebuilding America's Defenses, and you can read it at www.newamericancentury.org. So if there really are people that really want to keep America, you know, in the Middle East indefinitely, it wouldn't seem to me that they would really want to get peace over there.
Well, to be honest with you, I don't get myself involved in reading all these different reports around. That's not my focus, and I'm not going to take my focus there. My focus is on two things: what Jesus Christ did in my life and the things that he delivered me from, and the fact that as my Lord and Savior, my next focus is the fact that I'm not a lockstep George Bush man. Matter of fact, I'm very much against this proposed Palestinian state and the way they're doing that without as the settlement to peace, and for Jim Baker and the Iraq study group to come and profess that Palestinian state and Israel, carving Israel up in that manner is the solution to peace in Iraq is ludicrous. That's not going to solve either Israel or Iraq.
Well, what?
So I go to Iraq for this purpose, and that is to witness what I see our troops doing there. I'm not about some hierarchy of military control in this world or America of this world, but there are basic elements of evil there. That's the place that's the battleground that we're in. There is evil throughout the world, Pakistan being one of them and the Taliban being another. Afghanistan is seeming to... I was there for 10 days in my last trip, living among the troops there, guys on the ground, and they seem to be making ground there, and the Afghan army seems to be coming to a place of accomplishment where they can take the lead and bring security to Afghanistan.
Maybe, if you've been in Afghanistan, could you explain to me why we haven't tried to actually destroy the poppy crop there, this poppy crop, which is really the basis of the heroin trade in Europe? Why, since we control the country, don't we destroy the poppy crop there? This never did make any sense to me. Did you talk, or any of the troops there talk to you about that, or are they wonder why we don't try to destroy the poppy crop?
Well, I wasn't all over Afghanistan, and the area that I was in, the Pesh River Valley, that was not a factor there, so I couldn't speak to the poppy crop. The only thing I can say, the little bit that I've read, is that it's such a widespread problem in some remote areas, it's hard to control, so... But I can't really speak to that. That's not why I went.
Well, why did you go to Afghanistan specifically? Just to see how the soldiers were faring?
Yes, to see how they were faring and how, and to hear from them what progress that they thought they were making there.
How do the people there feel now? Certainly, I mean, these people have been involved in a war for 25, 27 years now. And I think they'd like to have peace and stability. Did you get a chance to talk to any of the Afghan people, or did you? Of course, you wouldn't. You'd have to go through an interpreter. But I feel so sorry for those people. I mean, and they just go from one war to the next war to the next war.
Well, I feel sorry for them also, and I feel sorry for the average person in Iraq the same. I mean, they have families, and they want to raise their children in a rather safe environment, just as we here want to raise our children and grandchildren in a safe environment. And that is the desire of most of their of the people in Iraq and most of the people in Afghanistan. They don't have the same standard of living that we have in the United States, but they love their children and they love their families, just as we do.
Sounds to me like life is pretty hard for the civilians there. I mean, they have electricity maybe 1 or 2 hours a day, and they have, you know, real problems with getting fresh water. And you know, after America has been there for almost 47 months, they still don't have water, or at least the general population doesn't on a regular basis, or good sewage or electricity regularly. There are no jobs for the people. We closed down all the factories. Why would Paul Bremer have gone over there and dissolved the Iraqi army and the Iraqi police force and the Iraqi civil service and closed down all the jobs so there wouldn't be any jobs for the people? They closed down all the factories. I never could understand that. Did anybody ever mention that when you were there?
Well, the army was shut down. Some of it disappeared and just went back into the woodwork. But those in control of the army were Sunni, and they were Saddamist loyalists. So I think it would be, I don't believe it would have behooved anybody in the goal that we are trying to achieve to leave the fox in charge of the chicken house.
Well, of course, a lot of them hated Saddam Hussein, but they were professional soldiers. In fact, during the 1990s, on two occasions, the military tried to overthrow Saddam, and at least according to Robert Baer in his book, See No Evil, he was a CIA agent, we carried the book, he said that they kept trying to overthrow Saddam, and each time in the 1990s, twice, he referred to the U.S. State Department refused to back the Iraqi generals who wanted to overthrow Saddam Hussein.
Well, I couldn't speak to what our State Department did. I'm not a big fan of the United States State Department. They are heavily lopsided in their dealings with Israel and the Palestinian state. When you see you have two sides and they negotiate a peace treaty, and then the late Yasser Arafat says one thing on this side, and then goes, when he's speaking to the Palestinians and their language around the corner, he spoke hate and destruction of all of Israel, etc. So, and the State Department is loaded with pro-Palestinians, not on a even scale with just trying to bring peace, but actually anti-Israel to some extent, and anything that not holding the Palestinian government accountable. And here we're doing it again as we ship millions of dollars into the PL with Hamas in the background, and the Fatah movement saying that the arms and et cetera will end up right in the hands of Hamas. We hear these things, yet we continue to send these arms. So it makes absolutely no sense. It makes absolutely no sense to chop Israel up in the manner of the roadmap to peace, which actually I would term more roadmap to hell.
I think you're absolutely right. Well, let's get back, of course, to Iraq. You think that we should expand the number of troops there. How long should we stay? Should we stay a year? 2 years, 5 years, 10 years if necessary to bring peace and stability?
I mean, well, I don't believe the goal is 5 years. I believe 2 years would be the outside of it if properly implemented and if we hold people accountable to the guidelines.
But, of course, are we going to hold them accountable to the guidelines? I mean, we've been talking like this. This is what we said in Vietnam. We're going to turn the war over to the South Vietnamese people. And you remember what happened in Vietnam.
Yes,
we'll be
ma'am.
Back here in just a moment. Well, I guess as Michael Payne and Mr. Payne, I think that we should stay in Iraq, and we should, of course, try to get the Iraqi army to actually be more effective. But, you know, do you really think that you're going to be able to get the Shia? Do you think we have a civil war there? Do you think we have a war between the Shia and the Sunni Muslims?
No, I do not believe we have a civil war going there. You have fringe groups, the Sunni radicals, who are, many of them are generals and ex-military from the Saddam armies, and they had a place of privilege under Saddam. Obviously, if the whole, if we were to say the whole Iraqi army during the times of Saddam had turned against Saddam, they would certainly have had no problem overthrowing Saddam and killing him or putting him out.
Unless, of course, our State Department, who was supporting Saddam, and, of course, Robert Baer said he never met an Iraqi who didn't believe the American government was keeping Saddam in power. The book, See No Evil, by Robert Baer, we carry it, and of course, you know, the Iraqi people really believed we were backing Saddam Hussein. I don't know why they would have thought that, but under any circumstances. So you don't think that there's a civil war? You don't think the Sunnis are killing the Shias and the Shias are killing the Sunnis?
Well, as I said, there are some fringe groups, but all Sunni do not hate all Shia, and all Shia do not hate all Sunni. You have some of these groups, just like we have radical fringe groups in the Hispanic community and in the black community and in the white community in this nation who strive through violence. The Italians have the mafia. You have your street gangs in L.A. who control turf by violence and murder and terror. So are we having a civil war in that respect? I don't believe so. It's wickedness run amok. You have the Sunni who are trying to destabilize what is trying to be done by the new Iraqi government. All the Iraqi people are not bent upon murder and mayhem. They have families. I have interviewed many of them. They live in the best mode that they can at this time under the circumstances. But not every one of them flips out the back door at night to go out and murder someone of the other sex.
Well, of course they wouldn't, but aren't there armed Shia groups that are killing Sunnis? And
yes.
Aren't Sunni groups that are killing Shias?
Yes, and they are, and within the last month we've seen a major crackdown on many of these with and I cannot speak to give a total answer to why it hasn't been earlier, but we are just, it takes time to train an army. And these things are just coming into place and starting to gel. And they were starting to gel before George Bush came on in the State of the Union and said, laid out this new plan and this new troop surge. And the Democrats, before George Bush announced the troop surge, were all for more troops over there. Then when he announced that he was going to send more over there, they all flipped to the other side, and they are against it now. So they were sending more troops in to help clamp down, which today I saw a few news.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, our guest this evening is Mr. Michael Payne. And if you're out there in the listening audience, and give us a call at 464-8295, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Mr. Payne believes that there is no civil war, despite the fact that some of the generals have said there's a civil war. Mr. Payne says that everybody doesn't want to kill everybody else, but that's, and he draws the analogy to what's going on in America, where we have dissident organizations here, but I really find it difficult to compare what's going on in the United States with what's going on in Iraq, wouldn't you? I mean, the state of violence here in the United States compared to the state of violence over there.
I'm simply saying to you that you're asking me, is there a civil war? I'm telling you, no, there is not a civil war. But you're, and what you're trying to say to me is that because there are some radical elements of the Sunni killing Shia and Shia-like al-Sadr killing and taking revenge on some of the Sunni, that makes it a civil war. It's not a civil war.
All right, fine. And so, how long do you think we should stay? A year, 2 years? Should we have a fixed date and say, if it's not solved by such and such a date, we'll pull out?
Well, I believe that we will see our troops start coming home no later than 2 years.
All right, fine. Well, if the end of 2 years things are no better, and do you think we should pull our troops completely out of there? Should we keep our troops there? Because apparently we've got this tremendous embassy over there. We have these large camps we built over there, and some people think that that's because we don't intend to leave. Do you think that we really intend to pull our troops out of there?
That's not my. That's not why I went. And that's not what I'm here to talk about. I don't, you know, that's a matter for speculation. I am concerned about the damage and the, I'm concerned about the way that the media has twisted what I know some of the, many of the accomplishments of our troops are in Iraq. I'm concerned about how this affects the morale of our troops and their emotional well-being and the emotional well-being of their families. I'm not on the air and I'm not going across the nation to support George Bush and all of his policies and all of the so-called, as you call them, neocons. That's not my concentration. My concentration is, again, the fact of the place that we are in and in the times that we are in, and the elements that are raising up around the world against us. I'll speak to that per the Bible. And I am also firmly against what's going on in Israel with the Palestinian implementation. And it's moving forward even though the Palestinians are not complying with their part of the treaty to move forward with the Palestinian state. I am firmly against the policies of open borders, both on the Canadian side and especially on the Mexican border. But as far as foreign policy goes, that's not what I'm about.
Well, but you certainly are backing the increase in the number of troops there. Do you think that 20,000 or troops are going to really solve the problem over there? You see, the thing that bothers me is that when we went into the first Gulf War in 1991, we had 695,000 troops over there to do the job. And, of course, the whole idea was to drive Saddam's troops out of Kuwait, and with really very little loss of life and 695,000 troops, we drove Saddam's troops out of Kuwait. And then, of course, we told the Iraqis to rise up and overthrow Saddam Hussein, and the Iraqis really did it. The Shias in the south, the Kurds in the north, rose up against Saddam Hussein, and then we didn't come to their help like we promised. They were slaughtered, tens of thousands of them. That was just so unconscionable policy on the part of our leaders. And then, of course, when we went in this time, though, we only sent 160,000 troops to do a job that 10 years ago we had almost 700,000 troops. It looks to me like we've never really put the number of troops in there to do the job.
Well, both the 150,000 or whatever when we went in, it did do the job. It went all the way through Baghdad, took control of Baghdad, and then
well, then why are we in the mess we are today if they did the job?
Well, you're talking about fighting an army versus fighting terrorists who have, and without, with Iraq not having an army and not being able to, they're the ones who can spot if a person is from this region or that region and is where he's supposed to be, and if he is a foreigner such as...
Hold that, we'll be right back.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Mr. Michael Payne. And of course, my point was, if we'd sent in sufficient troops, we could have clamped down, had martial law. We could have done away with the opposition instead of putting enough troops to do the job. Why, of course, we put in an inadequate number. The military always wanted many more troops than they were given. They were never allowed to win the war in Iraq any more than we were allowed to win the war in Vietnam. And I think if they'd let the military run it, would have been fine. The only trouble was they sent Paul Bremer over there, and the civilians ran this battle from the very beginning, and I think they made a mess of it. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Well, it certainly looks like a mess at the moment. But again, the Iraqi army is starting to get some feet on the ground and start to make accomplishments and take ground and take control of the ground. These are the things that are happening in the news lately. I saw a report today that bolsters that, where they had gone in and taken over a certain section of Baghdad and successfully, and our soldiers are not being, as was quoted today, the last several days since this new crackdown has started, there have been no deaths of U.S. soldiers there.
Well, do you think that the Shia soldiers, the Shia members of the Iraqi army, will fire on their fellow Shias? I mean, this is what one of the problems of the past, and is that the Shias in the army, really, of course, many of them were actually part of the death squads. And we were training them and giving them the weapons that they were using. You know, they were part of the Shia army during the day, and then they were part of the death squads at night.
And who was this again?
These were members of the Shia of the army. These were Shias who were in the Iraqi army. And there's many people who felt that the army was not being effective. Well, we'll just have to wait and see. But, you know, if it turns out that the Iraqi army can't do the job, do you think we should stay on?
The Iraqi army is stepping forward. They are, obviously, their leadership has been told by our military advisors over there that the urgency of the job. But, you know, as you were talking about how we had encouraged the Shia and the Kurds to stand forward and overthrow Iraq, and then we didn't support them, what do you have to say about if we pull our troops out now, the bloodbath that will incur from that point?
Well, I think there's going to be a
bloodbath. Should we pull out and watch that bloodbath happen?
I think there's going to be a bloodbath one way or the other, I'm afraid. This is Dr. Stan here. Well, let's go to Jack, who's calling from Michigan. Hi, Jack. Do you have a question for Mr. Payne?
Well, I do, Dr. Stan. I think this may be scriptural, and I think it's based in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 10 to 12, which I admonish the guest to review whenever possible, because it identifies those who receive not the love of the truth, and therefore, being in the world and of the world, were deluded by the various grand delusions which enabled them to believe the big lies, and unfortunately, the...
What was your point, Jack? Do you have a question for our
guest? Yeah, I do. I was wondering if by any chance, he had a chance to query the troops regarding the mysterious Osama Bush Laden, as well as the mercenaries that seemed to populate in equal numbers or even greater numbers than the actual military forces, why they would be there,
Are you speaking of the Iraqis who object to our being occupying their land? Are you speaking about the terrorists who are coming in from other countries? Maybe.
Well, he said he was there to talk with the U.S. troops, right?
Right.
Okay, so I'm questioning whether he has queried the U.S. people as to their morale regarding the presence of these mercenaries and the infinitely mysteriously disappearing Osama Bush Laden, for instance.
All right. Why we never caught Osama bin Laden. Jack is wondering, first of all, Are the troops wondering why we have never caught Osama bin Laden? I mean, after all, this was the reason, supposedly, we went to war back in October of 2001, was to catch Osama bin Laden and al-Zawahiri, his right-hand man, and we never tried to catch him. I mean, certainly they wouldn't let our troops in Afghanistan go after them, and a lot of people have said, well, if we were really went over there to get Osama bin Laden, why didn't we just finish the job, get Osama bin Laden, and then bring our troops home?
Well, I can't. The troops that I'm among, the guys out on patrol, this isn't the topic of their conversation, and it wasn't something that, I mean, for me to ask a sergeant patrolling a highway or carrying out security around a Iraqi village why the military hadn't caught Osama bin Laden, it would just have been pure projection.
I think that's a good answer. Okay, let's go to Mike, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Mike, do you have a question for our guest?
You guys keep talking about a war, and I just want to ask, what war? And getting a job done, and I just want to ask, what is the job that's supposed to get done?
All right, let's take one question at all, though. Do you think that, I think that Michael has said that he thinks that they're getting the job done, and now that we follow along with this program of the president and increase the number of troops there, and, of course, let the Iraqi army take control of the fighting, we'll get the job done. Would that be a fair assessment, Michael?
No, it's not.
I'm asking Michael, if I'm summarizing what he's saying, and then you can ask the question.
I believe that's fair.
All right, fine, Mike. Now, what was your question then to Michael?
Well, I'm just saying, what war? Because this just is not a war. It's an invasion for the sake of raising mayhem on another country.
All right, fine. Well, let's get Michael's response to that. Michael is saying that, look, I mean, we had no business invading that country, whether we liked the president of it or not. We had no business going in there, and a lot of people think we went in there because we wanted, of course, to disrupt their oil production, raise the prices of oil, and things of that sort. Are we justified in invading countries because we don't like the leaders?
Well, I believe that Saddam Hussein had many opportunities to allow the inspectors to inspect for weapons of mass destruction, and he did not. And the intelligence that was brought in from the intelligence agencies said that it seems, and I did go down and wasn't sent any transcripts of it myself, but, you know, it all seemed to point, from what we were told, that there was evidence, or at least the opinion, that Saddam Hussein was using weapons of mass destruction or stockpiling them to create mayhem and his own drive to control the Middle East and drive whatever his objective was there. But he did use poison gas upon the Kurds, and he did murder. He is said to be responsible for the deaths of those 1 million people during the time that he was in power.
But of course, we were backing him and financing him during that time, Michael. I'm sure you know that.
Not the total time. We were not.
We started backing him in 1980, and of course, you remember Donald Rumsfeld was over there in 83. We were giving him billions of dollars, and anybody who doubts that, we'd be glad to verify that. And of course, where did he get the material for his chemical weapons? He got them from us. Where did he get the material for his biological weapons? It came from the United States, and we have the government reports to show that. So aren't we somehow complicit in what this man had done? Certainly, right up until 1990, when he invaded, 1991, when he invaded, we were on good terms with him.
Well, again, I'm not here to speak about the world order and all this. It's in the Bible, it does speak of one world government coming. So if this, obviously you and your listeners believe are in the conspiracy theories to do this and that, I'm not saying you're wrong about this. What I'm saying to you is this. There are people in Iraq, the ordinary citizens of Iraq, they're not out to kill the other sex. They just want to live their life.
I'm sure they do. And I'm sure these people would just love to have peace over there. But, of course, do we have the right, is it a Christian thing to do, to send an army in to overthrow somebody we don't like? And then, of course, to make such a mess out of it as we have. And all the people who've been inadvertently killed there, and whether we've killed them or they've been killed as a result of the racial disharmony between the Shias and the Sunnis, do we bear any responsibility for what's going on over there today? But certainly, at least there was a peaceful situation. Saddam Hussein was a ruthless man. He was a ruthless killer. But then so are the rulers of Saudi Arabia, and of Kuwait, and of Egypt, and of Libya, and of Syria, and even of Iran. Is it a Christian thing that we are to go into every country where things are going on? Is this the practice of Christianity, to rule by the sword?
Oh, obviously, it's not the practice of Christianity, and it's not to invade countries is not the Christian way. What I'm simply saying to you is this, and I will say this to you, I believe that we are not long from the time of the return of Jesus, that these things are rising up and wickedness is rising up. Islam, I'm not afraid of what's going on now. These are things spoken of in the Bible, where there will be wars and rumors of war. And he says not to worry about these things. There will be nations rising against nations. This is part of the prophecy of the Bible of the end days, pestilence, and we certainly have that. We have AIDS rampant throughout the world. We have famine. We have earthquakes where there have never been earthquakes. We have a tsunami that killed 200,000 people. This is what the Bible speaks of. These are signs of the times coming, and those who do not accept Jesus as Lord will not spend eternity with the Father. That's what the Bible says. He says, I am the only way to the Father. And this I do believe.
I'm sorry, Mike, I had to cut you off because some terrible noise was coming on there. Well, I certainly would not disagree with you at all, but I wonder if maybe the policies that we're following are going to be in bringing this reality about rather than... I mean, I just am very concerned when... Uh-oh. Would you call Mr. Payne back? We seem to have lost Mr. Payne. So I'll get my producer to call Mr. Payne back. Henry, are you there in Connecticut?
Hello?
Hello, go ahead. We lost our guest, but if you have a question or comment, well, go right ahead.
Oh, your guest left?
Yeah, well, we're going to try to get him back again.
Oh, well, it was for your guest on the topic.
Yeah, we'll have him back in just a minute.
Right.
What was your question?
All right, if he hears me, what I want to know is that the reasons for us in Iraq, doesn't it have to do with that SLC? I mean, I won't tell you what the S stands for, but the L stands for little. And the C stands for country. That's what the French call that country over there in the Middle East, the one we call so-called Israel. Aren't we in Iraq mainly to defend and protect Israel's interests? And that's the reason why we're also going to roll into Iran?
Well, I personally don't think we're there at all to protect Israel's interests. In fact, I think we're going to really preside over the destruction of Israel. I think that's the real objective, but we can't tell the American people that.
How would that be, though? Because if they're knocking out Saddam, and then I know they put Saddam in the beginning back in the 80s, but if they take out Iran, so Israel wouldn't have any threats.
Well, because my very real fear is that if we go to war with Iran, there's going to be the whole of the Middle East is just going to go up in a sheet of flame, and there will be attacks on this country of Israel, which we've been putting pressure on time and time again. At one time, of course, they controlled the land all the way out to the Jordan River. And we forced them to give up most of the land at the point where they've actually pulled back into a very small enclave. And, of course, recently they went into Lebanon. And they might very well have won that war going into Lebanon. But, of course, instead of that, we forced them to pull back and lose that war. And although there are many, many people who believe, of course, that our government is pro-Israel.
If we really are,
why have we kept Mr. Pollard in jail all these years? 25 years?
Well, as far as Pollard, there are people that do want him out. There are people in the Congress that definitely want him out.
I'm talking about...
There's other people that don't want to allow it.
That's right. And, of course, why won't they allow it if our government's really run by the Zionists? But let Mr. Payne answer your question. And I think we lost Henry from Connecticut. I apologize, and if Henry wants to come back. But Mr. Payne, our caller who called while you were off the air, and he says he believes, of course, our policies are directly related to the bidding of Israel. His contention is that the reason we attacked Iraq was because we wanted to help Israel. The reason we're going to attack Iran is so that we can do away with the potential threat to Israel. How would you respond to him?
Well, Iran's not only a threat to Israel, and that is a true threat. They are a threat to Israel. They have spoken openly that Ahmadinejad has said that Israel won't be long in existence. They won't be on the map much longer. And that's not just an idle threat. The man fully believes it. I will say that I believe that the roadmap to peace is going, when that, it will be implemented, and it is George Bush's, who says he is a Christian, professes to be a Christian, is continuing to twist Israel's arm and strong arm them, it seems, to go ahead and give up all of the biblical, if you will, Judea and Samaria and Hebron and Bethlehem and Nazareth, which is what is called the West Bank. I heard some of what your caller was saying, and you were saying back to him, to give these spots up that are spoken of in the Bible where Jesus walked Gaza Strip, which is totally isolated from the West Bank, but it is a convenient place to bring weapons in to the Palestinian hands from Egypt in a border crossing that and tunnels that are basically uninhibited and out of control. They bring them into Gaza. Israel did not lose the war in Lebanon. It didn't have a clear-cut victory, but in many eyes, but Hezbollah got a shellacking. They can say what they want to say. I was in Israel for 2 months, 2 weeks last summer during that shootout that they were having. Are we in Iraq just to protect Israel? Again, it comes down to this. We are barreling down the road towards mayhem in this world. Israel is part of the target of all of those in the Middle East. Even Egypt said that Israel should be nuked. One of their legislators or government people said last week that Israel ought to be nuked. And this is not the language of a region that's seeking peace, but only the annihilation of Israel. In the Bible, this is not going to happen. They are going to take a hit. There's no doubt about it, I believe. But God, they are God's chosen people, and God is not going to allow them all to be destroyed.
I will certainly agree with you on that. We've got Mike back on the line, but I certainly agree with you. I believe that Israel is in the worst danger of ever, and the only thing, of course, is going to preserve Israel will be divine intervention.
Amen.
Let's go to Mike. Mike, did you want to present your question again?
Yeah, one more. What's going to happen when the United Nations decides to send inspectors to the United States looking for weapons of mass destruction?
All right, fine. Do you think that we're moving towards a world government and that perhaps the United Nations could turn against America?
Absolutely, I believe that. I don't believe America is going to stand as the sovereign superpower that it has enjoyed up to a point. The Bible speaks not of the United States at all, and those who try to say that this is, we have replaced Israel as God's chosen because we are a so-called Christian nation, are, that's a real stretch, and it is not true. United Nations, Bill Clinton had tried to put the United States military under, he had brought that forward, which it quickly got slapped down and everybody rose up at that time to bring United States military under the control of the United Nations.
That didn't get slapped down.
I'm sorry?
That didn't get slapped down. It went ahead.
Well, it certainly didn't go full speed ahead, but it will return, and the United Nations will, I do believe, someday take, in a not too awfully distant future, take control of a lot of things in this country.
I think you're absolutely right. And so, Mike, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
Well, that recent piece of legislation, when Congress gave the power to the president to go to war, I forget the name of that.
Hold that thought. Well, why don't you go ahead? What was your statement? Congress gave...
Yeah, I just can't remember the name of the document. I've got it right here somewhere. But that's all about our military doing the bidding of the United Nations.
Right, because it was under the United Nations authorization. You're right.
Yeah.
Hey, look, we got to run. Thanks very much, Mike. So anyway, we've got about 2 minutes to wrap up the program. What are the parting thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners today, Michael?
Simply this, as far as the I'm not pro-war, and I'm not here to defend George Bush in this war. What I'm here to say to you is our troops, or the guys up the street, the women, the young girls up the street, serving this nation, and we need to stand in support of them. As we've spoken a lot of here at the end of this program, I truly do believe that we are in the days that the Bible speaks of, and that we need to, those who do not know Jesus Christ need to accept him as Lord and Savior, for he says that is the only way to the Father. My website is takeastandministries.org. My email address is on there, and contact information, etc.
All right, Take a Stand Ministries, and certainly I agree that we are certainly in truly biblical times, in prophetic times. I believe we're moving into a period of crisis. I would certainly not necessarily agree that we ought to be over in the Middle East, but of course we're there. There's nothing we're going to be able to do about it, and I really fear there's going to be terrible, terrible repercussions for many of the policies that our government has been pursuing, but they could not do it if the good people of America were taking a stand. And the trouble is, where is the outcry from our religious leaders about the program of torture that was authorized by the White House itself? Did you get any thoughts on that at all, Michael, when you were over there? I mean, were the people outraged by what had gone on at Abu Ghraib and some of the policies carried out by the CIA?
Well, that wasn't a place that I, number one, went towards or had access to. So obviously, I abhor all torture.
And I think we should all abhor, but I think that the Christians ought to be speaking out against that. But of course, our leaders refuse to do it, and I believe that one day they're going to have to answer to God, not for what maybe they've done, but what they haven't done.
Well,
Michael, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate your dedication to getting out the word of the Lord.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and the great tragedy is why we're in a mess in the Middle East, and our boys are not coming home. And we can talk all we want to, but I'm afraid it's going to go on and on and on. And anybody who would like to understand what's really going on over there really needs to go to the website, newamericancentury.org, and pull down the pamphlet called Rebuilding America's Defenses, about 62 or 64 pages, and read it, and read it, and read it, and understand that this is the policy that is being followed by the godless people who are directing America's foreign and domestic policy today. We have troops in 130 nations throughout the world. They've just established a unified command for Africa. A unified command for Africa? Yes, a unified for command for Africa. Don't you feel safer now that we have a unified U.S. military command for Africa? And understand, of course, that God is going to deal with America for what we have done, and, of course, deal with the American people for what they have not done. Well, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours a day on almost 60 outlets. Some of them are just half an hour a week, but we do have an opportunity to reach people and talk to them and try to get them to understand that behind everything going on are powerful spiritual forces. And the back of all that men have plotted, back of all that saints have planned, back of the schemes of men and demons is a higher hidden hand. Warp and woof our heaven created, every pattern good and wise, oft perplexed by earthly standards, but good and wise in heavenly eyes. We are involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Our job is to reach as many people in the time that's allotted to us. We are to be the watchman on the wall, and we're to tell people what's happening. And if they don't want to listen, that's not our problem. That's their problem. But we are called to sound the alarm, and if we do not, their blood is on our hands. If they do not listen, then their blood is on their hands. And believe me, I believe we're moving into a very, very bloody time. So if you're out there in the listening audience, there's any way you can possibly help us, we'd love to hear from you. We quite frankly need your help. And the many, many things we have in the way of tape sets and videos and articles, you can go to our website and pull down our newsletters and copy them. And if you want to post any of the videos that we have made up on the Internet, that's fine. We want to get the message out. We do hope many of you certainly will want to think about getting some of the health products that we carry. Incidentally, we are carrying something called Iodorol, which is an iodine product. It's basically most Americans are iodine deficient because they took the iodine out of our milk and out of our bread and took the iodine out of about half of the salt that's sold in America. You don't know it. You thought you were getting iodized salts. You're not. And they substituted fluoride in our water. Why would you take the iodine out of our food and put fluoride in our water? Because then the fluoride certainly competes with the low dose of iodine for all the positions in the body and poisons the body. Well, we do carry Iodorol. It has about 12.5 milligrams of iodine in every tablet, and we think it's a great product. Barbara and I are taking it. So if you're interested in getting Iodorol, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We also carry the potassium iodide, which you should have on hand to protect your thyroid in case of a nuclear attack. We're putting together a four-tape set that will be available by the end of next week. On fluoride, you need to get that information, and you need to get information on magnesium and so many of the other things. If you'd like a health catalog or an emergency food catalog or a regular catalog, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. Understand what's going on over in the Middle East is a terrible disaster, but, well, may the Lord be with you.